today, but we're going to pick up some of the practical things which we can use in our lives, which we must learn to use in our lives, because this was the purpose of his work. Now, if we're going to understand what it is that Swedenborg provided, we're going to start off in what to you may appear to be a strange way. We draw your attention to the title of his last book, which he wrote when he was about 82 years of age, The True Christian Religion. And the title page reads as follows. It says, The True Christian Religion by Emanuel Swedenborg, Servant of the Lord Jesus Christ. Now some people say, well, that's, you know, just the man's humility. He is humble. He is stating himself to just be a servant, a willing instrument of Christ. But to understand the term servant, you have to look up the Apocalypse Explained and various other works to see the correspondences of the word servant. It has a special meaning. And among those meanings, we have the following. That a servant is one who communicates truth from the good of love. Now that in itself is a huge thing. It means that a person has to be conscious of love, has to be conscious of what good is all about, and that is an enormous theme and topic. And to understand the truths derived from that good of love and to express them. This is a whole lifetime of study, of activity. And he further goes on to explain through correspondences that a servant is one who obeys the Lord God and communicates truth and services or uses faithfully. So in saying that he is a servant of the Lord Jesus Christ, he's not making an egotistic claim, and he is not merely stating his humility before the divine. He is stating his function in life, and that is to communicate truth from the divine love and good. And what is this primary thing that he seeks to communicate? Well, we can sum it up in a very simple way. He was to prepare for the coming of a new church. Now, many people who are loath to understand or pursue theology say, well, oh, we don't want another one of these systems thrust upon us, and so they start reacting straight away. And so we have to understand what is meant by the term church. And here Swedenborg comes into his own, because he makes it very clear that church is not what is popularly interpreted in people's minds as some set organization which has buildings which are called churches, which has a hierarchical priesthood, and that there are various ceremonies to be followed and sacred rites to be performed and festivities of a holy nature to be pursued. Those things are all the externals of church. They are the scientifics of the church, if you like to call it that. He goes on to define church in a very extraordinary and special way. And here we're going to quote his exact words on what he means by the term church. Now we find that in the Arcana Celestia, and it's number 8938 for those who are interested in pursuing these things, he describes church as follows. The Lord's church is with everyone who is in a state of reception of charity and faith from the Lord, for the man himself is the church. Now this is a remarkable statement, that the individual, every individual man and woman, is a church. Now this throws the whole concept of church into an entirely new perspective. It means that each and every individual is capable of becoming a church. But so far he hasn't fully defined the function of church. But this realization brings an important impact into the human psyche. In the East, the term church is not used, but the term school is. And by school is understood working through spiritual methods and techniques to form a conscious relationship with God. That's what's understood by schoolwork. In the East, they would say the man or the woman has to become a school. But it's exactly the same thing that Swedenborg is talking about. The individual can form a functional relationship with the divine. Now, that's what church signifies. It doesn't signify an organization so much as it signifies a special conjunction between the individual and the creative, regenerative source of all reality, the divine. Now, people think that when they pray, when they carry out meditation, that they're in tune. Well, maybe, but sometimes people are only in tune with their own thoughts. When they pray, a lot of their prayers just circulate around inside themselves, like being in an echo chamber. Because unless there is feeling, unless there is love and aspiration associated with the prayer, it's not prayer at all. It's only words being repeated. In the East, in certain esoteric groups and schools, people learn to bring the emotions, the affections into play when they aspire. And they know that if they can enter into a functional relationship with the divine, there will be a reciprocal influx into themselves. Now remember, Christianity is an Eastern religion. Didn't start in Rome, didn't start with the Church of England or any other places like that. It is an Eastern religion. And in common with all the religions that were founded in the East, there are certain universal principles which are true in Christianity, and they're equally true in some of the older religions like Zoroastrianism and so on. The relationship with God has to be established. Now that brings us on to another quotation here, in which Swedenborg says, "The church is in man and not outside him." That's from Heaven and Hell. So this phrase, "the church is in man and not outside him," that is more or less equivalent to what the Lord once said when he said, "Behold, the kingdom of God is within you." And Swedenborg follows this up by saying that the church is the Lord's kingdom on earth. So church and this divine kingdom or consciousness and interrelationship with divine, creative, regenerative and uplifting energy, that relationship, which is a functional thing, that is church. Now it was Swedenborg's function to try and educate human beings into understanding what this church function is, because it's man's arcane or esoteric way of performing an integrative process whereby he becomes united, one with the divine essence. People have often speculated upon this. Various Indian and Tibetan philosophers have spoken about the necessity of attaining this state. But in the Western world there's a lot of haziness in religious and theological thinking about what this relationship is. And some wonderful books, which are quite rubbish when you read them, but gloriously printed and flowing words showing complete mastery of the English language have been written about all this philosophical relationship between the soul and God. And by the time you've finished reading these glorious books, you know less than when you started. Swedenborg abandons that sort of philosophical approach. He goes right to the core of the matter and says that all of us are created, unique, living beings. We are created for a purpose. We have a cosmic function to fulfill. But we can't fulfill that function on our own. We must have an interconnectedness with the source of all. Unless the energy, the love, the wisdom, the intelligence, and the know-how is given to us from above, we cannot, with our limited intelligence, do the whole lot and become superb cosmic beings. We need that connection. Now, in order to understand the nature of this connection, Swedenborg also made it clear that for Christians and for Jewish people and other related bodies, the Bible, which has been traditionally regarded as a holy book, has an inner sense. And Swedenborg's mighty contribution came when he began to show how the inner sense of the word can be uncovered. And it was through the great science of correspondences that this was achieved. Now, the Western world for centuries was familiar with the idea of symbols. But a symbol is only a representation of something which is beyond oneself. A symbol is a kind of device which points in a certain direction. we look at a symbol and it makes us think of something which is outside our immediate experience. But a correspondence is something different. A correspondence is a functional relationship between higher life and our life. Things down here are representative of things in higher life. But when we get into the functional nature of the correspondence, we live that relationship. We live that knowledge. Now, for example, a flower can correspond to spiritual truth. Many people use correspondences only as synonyms. Oh, yes, they look at the flower and, spiritual truth, and they've done their duty. They have simply substituted one word for another. That's not correspondences. That's only external semantics. If we study a flower, and we don't need to be botanists to do this, and meticulously look at the internal structure, we find that there is an awesome amount of detail there. A magnifying glass, or with the help of a microscope, we can begin to detect an enormous number of fine structural details. As we study some plant physiology, we'll find there is an amazing life of flowers. When we start to gather that information together and realize that all this complex of details relates to spiritual truth, then we begin to see that the flower itself is spelling out in its fine details the details of what these spiritual truths are. And as we begin to understand the details of these spiritual truths, so we come into a state of enlightenment. Correspondences are meant to enlighten us, not merely to give us alternative ways of referring to things. So it became Swedenborg's huge task to re-educate the Western world into the understanding of correspondences and to see that they differ from symbols, and to learn to use those correspondences as a means of establishing psychological and spiritual relationships with higher life, which includes the spiritual world, the celestial world, and of course the divine. And so this was one of his enormous contributions. And we must study the Arcana Celestia, and especially the Apocalypse Explained. That 6-volume book is so packed with correspondences that it will take the average reader a lifetime to really grasp and comprehend all that is indicated there. But we must do it. Now, why learn the correspondences? What's it got to do with the new church? Well, to become a new church means that one has to become a regenerated being. Now, the idea of regeneration is not new in the East. It may be new to readers and thinkers in the West, but it is not a new idea in the East. For tens of thousands of years, some peoples in the East have realized that it's impossible to go anywhere in life unless there is a restructuring of the whole of human nature. And as human beings, we are very detailed in our inner constitution. We have physiological, biological, anatomical, we have chemical, we have psychological, emotional, intellectual, spiritual, and psychic functions within us. And for the average person, these are rather mixed up. They're not sorted out. And many of these functions are in a runaway state. A lot of people have runaway emotions. They have outbursts of anger, or they're thrown into gloom and depression because things go against them. These are runaway emotions. Now, Swedenborg points out, as the whole of the ancient spirituality of the East has pointed out, that unless this runaway state of affairs is corrected, it's impossible for human beings to really grow into the stature of real people and to become true functional churches that are integrated with the divine essence. And therefore, he spends a lot of time on the theme of regeneration. Now, for those who perhaps not read his True Christian Religion, chapters 9 and 10 are essential reading, because these contain in a condensed form what every genuine spiritual school in the East has ever taught about producing newness of being inside of ourselves. And this is where it becomes very challenging, because many intelligent people read Swedenborg and they appreciate very much what he's written. They find there is tremendous clarification about spiritual matters presented in his ideas. And it's the spiritual clarity that they're interested in. Their minds have many problems solved because of the clarity of his writings. Well, what they fail to do is put into practice the indications that he gives. And the indications he gives are what were given to him from the divine. That's why, as the servant of the Lord Jesus Christ, he is the channel through which practical methods were transmitted to the human race for their renewal, for their rebirth, for their regeneration. And so we have to spend a short period of time on this concept of regeneration, because it's very vital. It's vital to all of us. Now, we function normally by a series of mechanical psychological processes which run through us automatically. Our job is to see the mechanicalness of our lives. Very often, when we're living busy lives, we're so interested in all the duties and tasks and challenges and stimuli that are around us that we have very little time to look within ourselves and to see the operations that are at work within our being. We cannot continue to go through life in that unobservant state unless we learn to observe and discover things about ourselves. It's impossible for change to occur. The assumption that if your faith in God is big enough, that will solve everything, is not true. And that became a pernicious doctrine, especially in the Christian churches, that if your faith in God, if your faith in Christ is strong enough, that will be your salvation. And it simply is not true. And our own logic should enable us to see this. We have a very complex muscular system and a bony leverage system. We have a complex nervous system that works those bones and muscles. We are built for action. We are built for the expression of our thoughts and feelings and states in deeds. And we are constructed to perform functional uses in the world. Just to have an intellectual and a partially emotional wrapped feeling that if you believe in God strongly enough, that your salvation is wrong. It has to be worked out in a practical way within our lives. And this is the practical side that Swedenborg tried to introduce into people. But before we can start acting out what is good, true, noble, worthy, loving, and useful, we have to correct the inevitable defects that are in our psyches. Now, it's no good pretending to ourselves that we don't have defects. We do. If we didn't have defects, if we were pure, holy, complete beings, we wouldn't be on this planet. We'd be in higher life. But we are very incomplete. And this idea of incompleteness, that we're just at a certain stage of development and so much more is to follow, is highlighted by the usual Eastern comparison between an undeveloped human being and a caterpillar. And this is a favorite analogy. The caterpillar crawls over leaves and twigs. And it may be destructive as it crawls over and eats away leaves and so on. But then it spins a cocoon, and after a remarkable process of restructuring the body, it emerges as a beautiful, colorful butterfly, which is not restricted to crawling over leaves and twigs. It flies in three-dimensional space. That analogy has been used many, many times, but it's only one analogy. If we study the world of nature, we find that there are lots of biological analogies. For example, a tadpole which has gills and only feeds on vegetable matter swimming around in the water undergoes metamorphosis or transformation to become a frog which can hop on the dry land and it can breathe air, and it then becomes a carnivorous animal that feeds upon flies and small insects. The ugly looking nymph that we find crawling around in the bottom of freshwater ponds, it undergoes a remarkable metamorphosis or transformation to become a delicate and beautiful looking dragonfly. And sometimes we encounter the drab brownish greenish thing that crawls out of a hole in the ground, climbs up a tree, splits its casing, and out emerges the cicada, which has a variety of colors, which is very noisy at times, and which has wings which can fly. Now these are dramatic transformations. Even the transformation of a maggot into a fly in itself is a remarkable process. Now physically we don't undergo such dramatic transformations. Our transformations are internal. We are built as spiritual beings to undergo a similar or corresponding metamorphosis in an internal way. And Swedenborg points out very clearly, as do all the ancient esoteric schools in the East, that unless we first of all learn to examine ourselves and see our defects, we cannot change. Now here are some quotations on this point. Now he says, anyone who has not looked into or examined himself ends up not knowing what is the evil that damns him and the good that saves him. And that's to be in a state of ignorance if we don't examine ourselves. And he further goes on to say, a purely natural person can see evils and good qualities in others and can also criticize them. But because he has not looked into and examined himself, he sees no evil in himself. I think some of our politicians are in that category. For the most part, they are not what we can truly call conscious men. But still, that's the hazard of that particular profession. Now we find, again, in the true Christian religion, one of those memorable relations, Swedenborg is in conversation with a cluster of celestial beings, and they collectively, speaking as though they are one person, speak to newcomers from the physical world, and they say to these newcomers, but my question is, did you ever examine your internal man and become aware of any longings for revenge, any longings to indulge your lusts, any longing for fraud and any longing for lying? Well, these are powerful questions. We may find it very hard to put such questions to ourselves and give honest answers. We get the question, say, oh no, that's not in my nature, no, I wouldn't do that. That's like the man who always declared that he never swore, he never smoked, and it had nothing to do with bad women. And whilst he's telling the tale, he's feeling around his pockets, and all of a sudden he says, damn, I've left my pipe in the bottle. As if this is blindness to one's habitual, mechanical, characteristic way of living. All of us are in the same boat, and for reasons that we shall see in a few minutes when we start to study consciousness. Self-examination is the only way to discover what's here. Other people can see some of the things in us. They often see the things we don't see. And we see many things in other people. We say, thank goodness I'm not like that. And that's where we become the hypocrite. We as human beings have a common resource of evils and negativities and bad states within ourselves. That's why there is so much psychiatry and psychotherapy and counseling in the world. People are in a mess. We may not go to counselors or psychiatrists because we feel that we can cope. But how well do we cope unless we learn to examine ourselves objectively and critically and honestly? We cannot know ourselves. And there's a trick about it. We may not recognize that we suffer from jealousy or anger, for example. But if we say to ourselves, right, I'm going to learn to take mental photographs of myself very frequently in life to see just exactly how I live. And one day we're having an argument with a person, we become very heated about it, and something clicks in the memory. take a photograph of yourself. And we take a photograph and we find that to our amazement, we've become very annoyed and very angry, and we're actually shouting at the other person. Now, when we see for ourselves that we are prone to anger, then it comes as a huge shock. It's only in the midst of one of these active manifestations of bad states that we can discover that those states are in us. We go sit down in an armchair at night and try to review ourselves. All these habits are passive and quiet. They're not functional. We don't see them. We don't even recognize that they play a role in our life. And so it's a very, very tricky and a very subtle thing to discover just what things rule us from time to time in daily life. And this power of observing oneself, of examining oneself, is crucial. But we'll only get results when something is functionally active within us and we catch ourselves out in the middle of it. We suffer from all sorts of shifting, changing moods. And if we learn to observe what's taking place as though we're looking at another person, we shall gradually uncover a whole range of maladies which are defects of the spirit and which inhibit and actually block our spiritual progression. Nothing of a new church or a higher connection with God can be established as long as this rubbish is within us. We symbolize ourselves as a cup, and the cup is full of negative states. What room is there for something finer? No room at all. Therefore, we have to learn to see what is within us. We have to examine ourselves crucially and critically and honestly. And when we see what's there, we have to try and resist those things. We don't want them to be there. Well, that's when we call upon the divine to help us. The divine does help us. Once we see the cause of the trouble, our anger, our resentment, our jealousy, our hostility, our anxiety, there's such a long list of these negative states, and it's a little different for each person. We have to discover what is the leading factor in our life and resist it, work against it, and ask, generally ask for higher help to overcome it. Now that's how we can begin to change ourselves. Now it's practical work of the highest order. As I said a little earlier, if you study those two chapters, chapters 9 and 10 in the True Christian Religion, tells you all about this process of repentance and regeneration. But it must be seen as a practical psycho-spiritual process, not just interesting reading that you don't have to practically attend to. Now, by putting some of these things into activity, we begin to fulfill something that Christ once said, that if you know these things, happy are ye if you do them. It's the doing that brings about this happiness. Now, the word translated as happiness is the Greek word makarios. The makarios has two meanings. It means happiness and blessedness. Now, blessedness is a higher state. Happiness is a lower state. We have many possible levels within us. Many people just seek happiness because it's the most obvious way of escaping from the miseries of life. But blessedness is a much greater state. And you find that Swedenborg very carefully distinguishes between blessedness and happiness. And in Conjugal Love, he talks about the exquisiteness of the conjugal state in the celestial realm. And for celestial beings, it is, which is in the higher part of the mind, it is experienced as a blessed state. But for people who have more of a spiritual disposition, therefore lower down the cosmic scale, it is experienced as a state of happiness. Happiness and blessedness are quite different. So you can take those words of the Lord at two levels. If you know these things, happy are ye if you do them. Or if you know these things, blessed are ye if you do them. There are two levels implicit in that. Or we must say to ourselves, well, which level do I seek? Am I going to be content with just a happiness that can come along, which may only be a transient happiness? Or can there be a state of blessedness in which something from the divine actually blesses me and endows me with new space and a new organization and completely transforms and changes my life. We are looking towards a complete transformation of our being. And that's why the whole process of regeneration, renewal, and rebirth is essential. In Eastern esoteric schools, such as you had in Tibet, for example, before the Chinese took over, in some forms of esoteric Buddhism, in esoteric Islam and so on, where people really follow practices faithfully, many of them use correspondences because traces of the science of correspondences are even today with some of these people. For example, in the Sufi concept of reality, you have God. Immediately below God is the world of archetypes, all the patterns of everything that can come into existence. Then comes the world of symbols, which gives us our intellectual capacity to analyze and interpret things, and below that is the world of physical reality, and below that is the world of shadows, where people in their imagination fall into negative states. And the Sufis know that the lower worlds correspond to the intermediate worlds and correspond to the higher worlds. And Sufi schools, which are hard for Western people to get into, live sincerely with this knowledge of correspondences, and they try to aspire towards the highest reality. They try to open themselves to receive the divine influx into themselves. And they work at it with great diligence. In fact, when we make a study of some of these practices, we say, well, now, how can these people do so much work upon themselves, such as self-sensing, self-observing, self-remembering, Zika or God-remembering, and all these other things, and still go about their daily work? If you're going to do all those inner things, you would have to withdraw from daily life and go into retreat, go into a monastery or some hidden school in the Himalayas or something like that. Now, well, some people do go into states of isolation, but it's not necessary. If one has the enthusiasm for living a more abundant, a meaningful, a purposeful, and a creative life, one will find time, because you begin to love the whole concept of transformation, rebirth, so that one becomes a new creature. A frog is so different from a tadpole. A cicada is so different from that little crawling thing that moves around in tunnels in the ground. We have to see that a transformed, awakened, conscious soul is enormously different from this pitiful thing that we live with at this present moment. And unless we can see the difference, we've got nothing to aspire for. If we can, in our imagination, see that there is something great and enormous which is attractive to us, which is stimulating and inspiring, then we begin to love carrying out the methods that leads to that change of state. What we love, we will do. We will find ways and means of doing what we love most of all. And so we have to learn to change our leading love from just satisfying our whims and fancies into fulfilling our cosmic duty in becoming what God created us to be. That is, a fully conscious soul in living, functional relationship with Himself and carrying out cosmic uses at spiritual and celestial levels. Human beings have a tremendous spiritual destiny before them, but it doesn't come automatically. We've got to make it so within our lives. And so this process of working upon ourselves sincerely and honestly, that's not exactly our test in life, but it's the gateway that leads to further change. All the big, the conscious, the good, the noble, the sacred things which we desire very much, they cannot possibly enter us until we have carried out the work which the Greeks call kenos, or emptying out. We have to empty ourselves out of the lower to make room for the higher. Now, this is common sense. The funny part is, people don't live by common sense. They live in imagination. They read books on metaphysics where if you do this and you meditate this way and you do this, that and the other, all the goodies will come to you. And it doesn't work like that, because very few of these books talk about the process of self-cleansing. Oh no, that's taboo, that's too much hard work, and people don't want it. They want the quick fix, the shortcut, and there are no shortcuts to life. Life is a genetic, evolving, developing, unfolding process in which lesser states give rise to greater states, and greater states keep growing eternally into radiant states. And everything is in a sequence, an orderly sequence, and you can't jump steps. Imagine a full-born, a fully mature adult leaping out of the mother's womb. It's a good imagination, I know. But just imagine that happening. No nappies for change. Only perhaps an irritable, aggressive adult to cope with. But it would be an anomaly. It would be ridiculous. Because we know that everything has to have a small beginning. The fertilized egg is microscopic. And the early embryo is microscopic. But it gradually evolves and develops in shape and size until it's able to function at first as a breathing, eating, a defecating and urinating individual for a while, and then it becomes in control of its faculties and functions and grows through childhood, adolescence into adulthood. There are stages of growth. What occurs in our physical life reflects and corresponds to our spiritual growth. Inwardly, we are infants. We are very, very immature. We have to go through a long training, learning, restructuring process. And it's just as acute, just as intensive, and sometimes just as painful as our external experiences in growing up. We have to face this honestly. There are times when sheer delight enters into the mind because we gain new insights, we grasp new truths, and we feel new states of joy, delight, love, affection, and so on. And then we go through periods in which our negativities rise up and we have our setbacks. And then we look around to see if we can blame somebody for it. I feel this way because it's her fault. Or he said something to me and it's made me feel lousy. That is not right. All moods, all changes of state occur in us, and it's our responsibility to cope with them. We cannot possibly blame another person for the moods we get into. And yet we do this habitually. Look what you've done. Look what you've made me do. That's projection. That's refusing to accept personal responsibility and blaming the other person for it. It's so easy to do to blame somebody else. Conscious life requires that we sincerely and honestly look to our negativities and say, I've allowed that to happen in me. I'm going to strive not to allow it to happen again. And at first, we make this resolution. We're not going to let, shall we say, certain moodiness overtake us. We're going to fail many, many times at first until we get into the knack of calling upon the divine to help us to cope with what we see as rising up with us. Then we find that a very great peaceful energy truly enters into us, and we can cope. We are not dismayed, we are not thrown by these rising states, and gradually we can overwhelm them. We need the higher help to do it. Now, this process of regeneration, it goes on all through our lives. It is not a one-off situation. Some people regard regeneration as a kind of initiation. And once you've been through the initiation, all is well. No, it's not like this. Once we start the process of self-perfecting, and we learn to examine ourselves, we learn to connect better, finer, richer, and purer states with corresponding spiritual and divine states to try and establish a higher harmony within us. Once we start on that pathway, we can never stop. Just going through an initial period of rebirth in which we see new truths and we've got new enthusiasms, that is not our change. It's only the beginning of a change. So if we start working upon ourselves, we must work diligently until the last breath. And that's why you have in the book of Revelation such statements as, that he that overcometh will be made a pillar in the temple, and he who endureth to the end You see, these are instructions. They are practical instructions. They're not just statements to make us wonder and ponder about the mystery of things. These are direct instructions to human beings to keep them functionally active. We can never stop analyzing out, discovering inadequacies and defects, and trying to eliminate them to the time we die. And, surprise, surprise to many people, Swedenborg points out that even celestial beings, they still carry a lot of negativities. And they sometimes are caught up in their negativities, and they become precipitated into the lower, not the infernal, but a lower world, the spiritual world. And they forget that they've even been in heavenly states. Until they work through and correct the defects, then they can return to their celestial state. So we mustn't imagine that just knowing that we've got a few defects there and somehow we can brush them under the carpet that we're right. What Swedenborg presents is a very self-discipline, a very devoted, a very passionate approach to truly make something big of our lives. And it's worth the effort. So one needs to consult that true Christian religion and really read through the section on regeneration. You'll find that so much more meaning will come out of it when you start reading it again. Now we find that in order to work upon ourselves, we need to have a degree of consciousness. This is called by Swedenborg, and he follows the divine word in this, it's called to be awake, awakening or arousal. Now, if we use an index of the Bible, a concordance, we find that there are many references to being awake, wakefulness, throughout both the Old and the New Testaments. And it's worth running through these references because, once again, they are descriptions of our states, and very often there are instructions about what we can do. Now, it's been recognized in the East for a long, long time that man is in two possible states. He is asleep or he is awake. If he is awake, he is conscious. If he is asleep, he lives as an ordinary person, goes around doing all the usual things, but he's simply not conscious of why he lives, how he lives, what he is living for. He's simply not conscious of those things. Now, in the word, to live involved in one's self-motivated interests and so on, even though we may be very bright and very intelligent in what we do, that is to be asleep. But when a spiritual awakening has taken place and we become the recipients of a higher influx, and a spiritual light enters us which illuminates our being and enables us to see ourselves more critically, more honestly and more openly, then we have spiritual wakefulness. And that is a completely different state altogether. So the struggle in the East is for consciousness. Now, to give an example, years ago when lamas in certain schools in Tibet, and when I say schools, they were universities with up to 10,000 students, a really big campus, and there were several of these scattered through Tibet. For those who were going on to study the depths of spiritual teaching, rather than become physicians and teachers, the study of consciousness or wakefulness was obligatory, and the curriculum occupied 20 intensive years. 20 years of studying consciousness, because the Tibetans insisted, how can you understand the sacred scriptures if you're just using the dull, sleeping mind and you see things only on the outside? You have to know the ins and outs of consciousness. And so consciousness in every conceivable detail was not only studied, but practiced. And that's before a person could really begin. Now, in the Western world, consciousness has been in a frightful state for the last 50 or 60 years. It's only recently, it's only in the last decade or so, that psychologists are now turning their attention to this thing called consciousness. Oh, you know, there might be something in it. because for the last 50 or 60 years, behaviorism has ruled Western psychology. And behaviorism has this attitude that we are a reactive instrument. And the only scientific study of man is to study the stimuli that act upon him and the responses that he shows in regard to those stimuli. Now that's, in essence, the whole of behaviorism. When you say, well, a stimulus applied, you have feelings and you start to think, no, forget about all what you call thoughts and feelings. That doesn't matter. That's only the black box inside you. All we're interested in is the stimulus and the response, because we can scientifically measure it. You can't scientifically measure what's on the inside. So therefore, as far as we're concerned, there is no such thing as consciousness and there is no such thing as feeling. Objective states that you talk about in words. Now that has been the dominating psychology, which has dominated most Western universities. Has produced a very big cluster of psychologists who think along those lines, that human beings are just reactive devices. And that's called stimulus response psychology. Well, in recent years, it's realized that picture is horribly incomplete. And the result is people are now studying consciousness. And it's very amusing to read the scientific journals and to see these theories that are being presented as to what consciousness is. Some say it's just the arousal of certain nerve centers in the brain, such as the locus coeruleus in the brain and the reticular formation. Others say within the nerve cells there are tiny little microfibrils and quantum events, packages of energy jumping around, that stimulates the brain, that causes consciousness. The most incredible theories are now arising because a new topic is being given to the busy bees, the academics and the intellectuals, and it's a heyday. You can think of anything you like. You can write a paper about it and there's no one there to contradict you. Because nobody else knows what consciousness is. They've never worked towards it. For them it's a theory. Now from the earliest times it's been recognized that consciousness is spiritual light. It is the light from the divine which flowing into a person illuminates the whole being. Our ordinary state of wakefulness is a state of awareness or sensitivity. All organisms have sensitivity. A plant will respond to stimuli. We've all seen the way the head of a sunflower will move round and track the course of the sun. That's because it's sensitive to sunlight. Shoots grow towards the light, roots grow towards the direction in which gravity pulls, and so on. Animals have more sensitivity, that's why they respond. They're swimming in the water, in the sea, and you come over rocks, you may see a nice tube worm, all in an expanded state. But as soon as your shadow goes over it, immediately it retreats into its tube, so fast that you hardly realize it's taken place. That sensitivity, animals have sensitivity. We have the full measure of sensitivity. It's a very great energy. It enables us to live and feel and think and act and respond. But it's only sensitivity. Sensitive energy gives us awareness. We are aware of being alive. But in our awareness, we don't see the spiritual structure of things. We don't even see our own spiritual structure. There's all the world of difference between wakefulness and this sleeping state. And so the study of our consciousness is very important to us. We need the light from a higher level to illuminate us. Why? Because when spiritual light enters us, it does two things for us. It opens our spiritual senses and it enables us to see spiritual meanings and things that may enable us to actually see spiritual things and spiritual beings. But also it floods the whole of our being with an interior light, and we are able to see every detail in our lower self. It is the inner self, the higher part of us, which is capable of receiving spiritual light, and that's the light of consciousness. It illuminates the dark, the seedy, the repressed, the unconscious components of our being. And so, by the inner light that is given to us, we can truthfully see for ourselves what is there. And that adds to our power of self-examination. The more clearly we can see ourselves, the more readily we can work against the troubles that are part and parcel of our existence. And so we must pray for that inner light. We must earnestly pray for it. And so it's a good idea to run through Swedenborg, and he's got many references to sleep and wakefulness. In fact, I think you'll find in the Apocalypse Explained, I've just forgotten the exact reference, I can give it to you a little bit later. He's got a whole section covering 5 or 6 pages on sleep and wakefulness, with all sorts of practical suggestions as to how we can cope. The first thing is to distinguish between being in this sleeping state, which is our usual daily state, even though the eyes are open, because we're blind to spiritual reality. To be awake is to receive spiritual light into ourselves, and that means that we struggle towards it. We have to struggle towards the light. We have to aspire towards it. We have to pray for it. Because unless we make an effort, there won't be a reciprocal response from the divine. Now, if we don't have consciousness of who and what we are, then how can we understand what our role is in life? How can we understand who and what we are in this universe? Now, the Western world is in a very mixed-up state at the present time regarding this. In all academies of higher learning, the Darwinian and neo-Darwinian theories of evolution are the predominant philosophies of biological science, and they form the official doctrine. This is only by arbitrary agreement amongst scholars that this is so, but it's unfortunately the case. Now, in the Darwinian idea, life starts off in an abiogenic way. That means it starts off from lifeless matter. And various experiments carried out by the chemist Miller, for example, shows if you have some water, you put a little methane gas and a little carbon dioxide gas, and you seal the flask and you boil it for several days, you'll finish up with a few amino acids. And they say that is proof of how life started on the earth. You start over with some inorganic materials and a little bit of cooking, and organic molecules are produced. Well, to extrapolate from a flask to a whole infinite universe with myriads of planets undoubtedly with a variety of life forms on, and say what I found in my flask is the way everything works, is ridiculous. That's a piece of absolute stupidity. But this is how the scientific mind thinks. If you can demonstrate something in a laboratory, it's universally true. Now, it may be locally true, but not necessarily universally true. Now, from that beginning, from lifeless matter, and that was assumed to be accidental combinations of various chemical elements under the action of ultraviolet radiation, molecules were produced, DNA molecules, protein molecules, and they became self-growing, self-repairing, self-evolving. And gradually genes were formed which controlled certain biochemical patterns. Some gene patterns were more efficient than others in surviving in a difficult environment. And so the events of life, they picked out the fittest ones to survive. Those became the survivors, and their offspring became the successful organisms that have lasted and have changed over millions of years. And the whole of life fans out from fluctuations, variations, mutations, and all sorts of genetic changes. On the surface, it seems to be a very logical theory, but it has so many gaps and has so many incredible inadequacies. But this is the dangerous part of the Darwinian and neo-Darwinian theories. The theories say that life started off fortuitously, accidentally, and that this growth of life is only opportunistic. Life, having started, begins to explore its environment and gradually masters its environment. It's opportunistic. It doesn't have an aim or a purpose. It just grows and makes the most of its opportunities. And so science, acting on its own theory, says there is no purpose in life. Life just grows. Now what's true for life in general is true for human individuals. We are just caught up in the stream of life. We are accidental products of accidental beginnings. And there's no purpose in our life. We just exist and we have to make the most of it. And when we die, we decompose and there is nothing else. Science does not give any hope to any individual that there is a continuity of life. That's the murderousness of it. It tries to cut out spiritual life. And there are many scientists who say, if you have a dream of the immortality of the soul, that is merely an unscientific wish. In other words, science is the final arbiter. It pretends it knows the whole blooming story, and yet these people don't even know what consciousness is, even though if they made an effort they could experience consciousness directly. But they won't do it. They want to play with words. They want their theories, and from their theories they want to be little gods who explain everything. They feel that by explaining things, then that's equivalent to the creation of things. Now Swedenborg presents a marvelous counter to all of this gross and quite stupid and meaningless materialism. He himself is a practicing scientist, very meticulous in his calculations, his observations, his measurements, records, and so on. When his spiritual senses are open and he directly experienced and moved about in the spiritual and sometimes the celestial world and sometimes the infernal worlds, with the accuracy, the honesty, the integrity of a good, well-trained scientist, he faithfully reported exactly what he encountered. He gives us a detailed, accurate description of spiritual life as he saw it, as he experienced it. And in his spiritual diary, he describes so many of the states that swept through him, sometimes very painful states, sometimes very desperate, frightening states, at other times exhilarating states, that his was direct experience for 27 years or more. So he gives a direct description of a continuing life, which gives the lie to the scientific theory. It's only a scientific theory that there's nothing after death. A pure speculative theory by men who wish to abandon the idea of God. Darwin, as a young person, the son of a wealthy doctor, was sent up to Edinburgh University to study medicine. He was there for about 3 years, and his father heard about his excessive boozing and womanizing and said, right, the medical course finishes, you're coming down to Cambridge where I can see what you're up to, and you're going to study theology. So he went into training to become a minister of religion. There he met this Dr. Henslow, who was a theologian but also a naturalist. It was Henslow who introduced him to the study of nature. Darwin never worked in his life. He studied a lot, and he was a very good naturalist, and he had the good fortune to travel around the world in the Beagle, made all of his observations, and invented his theory of evolution. But he was reacting against his father's wish for him to become a minister of religion. He detested his father, yet all of his life he depended upon his father's money for his own upkeep and for the upkeep of his family. So there's a love-hate relationship in Darwin's life. And in despising his father, he despised his father's belief in God. Darwin felt that he was compelled to study religion, and he didn't want it. And he tried to bring out a scientific proof of the impossibility of God. He described a certain wasp that stings particular caterpillars so they can't move, but they remain alive, and it then lays its eggs in their bodies. The eggs hatch out and the little larvae eat the living but paralyzed flesh of the caterpillar. And Darwin says, a God who creates such a monstrous arrangement cannot possibly exist. How can there be a merciful God who allows little caterpillars to eat the living flesh of a caterpillar? Look, everything in this universe feeds upon everything else. That's the order of things. We feed upon plants, upon animal tissues, and we happen to be meat eaters. The animals and plants we eat, they in turn have eaten in their own way. Vegetables draw upon the nutrients of the earth, they draw upon the energy of sunlight. That's their eating. Everything is eating everything else. We have to ask the question, what eats us? Are we eaten by envy? Are we eaten by fear? Are we eaten by paralysis of initiative so that we don't really work upon ourselves? Are we paralyzed by strange theological concepts that it's a wicked thing to go out and study the things of the universe, that you must only pray to God and not do anything else of an external nature lest your soul suffer in hell forever? These are some of the things that eat us up. We can be eaten up by many, many things. So you have to say to yourself, what is the highest reality that can eat me? Which is the same thing as saying it embraces you and it takes it into itself. Divine love. To be eaten, or if you like, caught up and assimilated by divine love. That's the greatest reality. It doesn't sound very much in words, but it is a tremendous, living, vibrant, cosmic dynamic. And so we have Swedenborg presenting with his accurate descriptions of life in other worlds, and much of which is summarized in Heaven and Hell, but it's found in parts of the Arcana Celestia, and indeed all through his writings, these vivid descriptions. Many people upon reading these things are helped because they develop the confidence that life goes on, and they're helped by realizing that life carries a responsibility. If I'm alive and my life goes on, for what purpose? What are we going to do in that world? Swedenborg tries to point out that there are endless, infinitely many occupations which we can pursue in the world. And we have to develop within ourselves a vision of what we're heading into. The great German mathematician Gauss, in his study, had a very big desk. At one end of the desk was a huge pile of papers. At the other end of the desk was another pile of papers. His friends would come and say, why the two piles of papers? And Gauss would say, well, on the right hand side, those are the problems I'm working at the present time. The papers on the left hand side represent problems which are too hard for me, but I know that in the spiritual world I'll have the power to solve them, so I'm remembering them. Now that's practical. He is looking forward to an ongoing life of creative investigation and exploration. Now that is real faith. Now, this is how we have to learn to live. We must see ourselves not just as dwellers in a body, but as souls who are part of an enormously long, in fact, an infinitely long stream of growth and development. This is the reality. Each person has an individual pathway to follow, and each one of us must try to make the most of that best possible of all pathways for ourselves. That's our individual effort. We're going to differ from one another. Well, that doesn't matter. Individual differences make up the great variety of the world. And when that variety of things is harmonized, you have the unity of heavenly life. Harmony is a unity of relatively unlike things brought together with precision, like a beautifully made watch that's so efficient you can hardly hear it ticking. It's that sort of functional harmony which constitutes the universe, where all the variety of individuals and states work together with mutual respect, with mutual affection, with mutual efficiency. And that's what we're working towards. But we need that wakefulness or consciousness. We get that through observing ourselves. We get that by trying to become a functional church in which the divine works in us and through us. But there's something else that is connected with our lives. And that is, whilst we're alive in the body, we not only have to work towards an eternal future, but we are expected to carry out certain functions here and now to justify our existence. Now here we shall again quote Swedenborg. We don't exist just for the fun of being here. We don't exist just for the benefit of the taxation department. Now, in the Arcana Celestia, and it's number 3702, Swedenborg has this to say about our present existence. All goods and truths descend from the Lord and ascend to Him. Man has been so created that the divine things of the Lord may descend through him, down to the ultimates of nature, and from the ultimates of nature may ascend to him, so that man might be a medium that unites the divine with the world of nature, and the world of nature with the divine, and that thus the very ultimates of nature might live from the divine through man as the uniting medium. This is the case if man had lived according to divine order. This is a remarkable thing, that we are necessary for the functionality of the universe. We should be channels or instruments through which something flows into manifestation. And reciprocally, something from the world of manifestation has to flow through us and be returned to the divine. We are a functional link between the divine and the outer world. And he further goes on to say, it is through man alone there is a descent from the heavens into the world and an ascent from the world into the heavens. It is the brain and its interiors through which the descent and ascent is effected. Now this gives us a clue as to how we should function. Now let's say that this is the human brain. We have the spinal cord. Now from the cerebral cortex, or from the motor regions of the cerebral cortex, we have a very large number of motor fibers which pass down through the spinal cord. Then they make synaptic connections with nerves that go out to different parts of the body, to the various muscles. So here we have a descending pathway, and also we have an ascending pathway in which sensory nerves from the outside world pass into the spinal cord at various levels, and these sensory fibers, they move upwards into the brain. Now here we're representing in a very crude way the actual pathways, because we know that in ascending pathways the fibers, the sensory fibers, they make conjunction with the thalamus, and then from the thalamus there is a spreading out to the different sensory areas of the brain. Now this is what Swedenborg was describing, that in the brain we have these descending pathways and these ascending pathways, and what he's saying is this corresponds to our cosmic function in the universe. Now let's try to understand how this works. Let us suppose a person has spent a great deal of time trying to understand the nature of life, trying to understand the creative spirit which runs through the whole of history and inspires human beings. Alright, now into the mind there may come concepts of divinity. Now when people start pondering upon these things and they wonder how creation took place, they wonder how the world is organized, they wonder what is the meaning and the significance, the sense and the aim of all of our existence. When people begin to ponder these things, they transform these concepts into volitions. And they say to themselves, obviously it is a good, a kindly and a creative divinity which has given us the privilege of being alive, the experience of being alive, so that we can grow, so that we can learn, so that we can enter into relationships with other people, form friendships and so on. There is a fundamental goodness. Now if we translate some of these concepts of divinity, of love and goodness, into volition, so that we wish to act as the divine acts, in a kindly, functional, useful, serviceable way, we begin to produce in our life uses. Our volitions are turned into serviceable uses. Now that means a little bit of a higher heavenly state is made manifest in what we do. Now that's the heavenly state coming into a state of manifestation in the ultimates or the externals of life. Now, supposing we take an interest in the world around us, we start to carefully look at the nature of living things, of stones, rocks, atoms, molecules, and so on. And so here we have external studies. Now, the more we study things, the more we become amazed at the fine structure. In Swedenborg's day, the microscope was just growing as an instrument of scientific observation. Since his day, marvelous optical microscopes have been developed, the electron microscope has been developed, and the tunneling electron microscope has been developed, whereby you can see individual atoms. Now, Swedenborg said in several parts of his writings to the reader, procure a microscope, look at the small animals, look at the fine structure of plants, and be amazed by the details that you see. Now that's the indication. The more we look at things and the more fine structures that we can see how they functionally fit together to make things work. And we begin to see that this is the hand of God. But right down to the most minute details, there are meaningful interactions between molecules and atoms, between electric charges and quantum states. Biochemical substances are interconnected with each other in the most amazing cycles and pathways of transformation. And all these working together make up our physiological functions. And the more we study these fine details, the more astonished we are at how close, how meticulous is the care of the divine in providing for these things. And so we develop, through our studies, a sense of wonder. And it's also a sense of appreciation that such things are there to be seen. Now, when we take these detailed studies, this sense of wonder, up through our ascending pathways, we begin to develop a sense of spontaneous worship. Now, the cousin of Swedenborg, Linnaeus, the great classifier of plants and animals, every week he would go on an expedition to collect plants. And on one occasion, and people would go along with him, they used to take a little band and they'd play the drums and blow trumpets because it was a big event. He was a famous man. And everybody loved going on these picnic collecting sprees with him. Well, he was leading a party through the bush and he came across a gorse bush. And it was in full flower, golden yellow flowers. He was so affected, he knelt before it and prayed. That's a sense of wonderment. Now, when we get this sense of wonderment with the external things we see, we convert it into appreciation, evaluation, delight. And it becomes a spontaneous act of thanksgiving that we've seen and understood and felt such things. And we're related to the divine. We are handing back to the divine the joy and the delight of all the meticulous details we've come across. That's the return cycle. We act out the good, the truth, the wisdom, the usefulness that is inspired into us. And from the visible world, we gather up and we take into ourselves the knowledge of things, and we see spiritual and divine things in the external forms around us. Now, Swedenborg points out in several places that when we gather external knowledges and we begin to appreciate all the details that are in them, our spiritual side grows. not because of just the materiality of things, but because patterns of creative expression are there. We discern the patterns. That such is the spirit of rejoicing, the spirit of thanksgiving within us, as a remarkable spontaneous thing, like Linnaeus kneeling down and praying to God for thanksgiving for this beautiful plant before him. So we, in a spontaneous way, express our delight, and so we return to the Creator the fruits of external creation in a modified, a sublimated, an enriched, and an enlightened form. We enlighten ourselves by the study of nature, if only we can see that all is the work of a majestic creative principle, filling the world with innumerable details to educate us. That is such an important thing for us to comprehend and understand. Now look, there's 100 things that we could speak about regarding Swedenborg. We can't just go on listing them. But there's one very important last thing that I'd like to mention as part of his contribution to our effectiveness as living beings on this planet. From the earliest times, human beings have tried to figure out the nature of God. And when we look through comparative religions and we see some of these theories, we find that there is an incredible range of them. Now, you have the relative monistic theory that God is a vast, formless, indefinable energy field. It sounds good. In the present age, when we talk about magnetic fields, electrical fields, and so on, God as a field of energy sounds enticing. But how do you relate yourself to an energy field? If it's formless and shapeless, which part of it are you going to grab hold of, and which part are you going to relate yourself to? That becomes very difficult. At the other extreme, God in some systems is visualized as a sort of Superman. He is an individual who is able to do all sorts of wonderful tricks, and he produces his cosmic magic called Maya, or illusion, and everybody lives in an illusory universe. But this God who produces the tricks is quite mortal, and after millions of years, he dies and everything disappears. Oh yes, in some Eastern religions, this is the regular part, that God only lives for so many millions of years and he dies and then everything goes. Quite amazing. And then you have in Hinduism, God is often spoken of as Vishnu. And some wonderful carvings appear in which Vishnu is seen lying on his side and supporting his head and his hand. And he's in a partial state of sleep, and he is dreaming, and out of his navel emerges a lotus flower. And on the lotus flower is Brahma and the four sons of Brahma, and these are the agents responsible for giving all the finishing touches to the world. And Brahma is asleep on the infinite ocean of eternity, and he's dreaming the world into existence. He's in a half-awake state. And so Indian religious philosophy goes on to say that the dream of Vishnu produces this world, which to us is so tangible because we're part of the dream. And this lasts for millions of years. But then Vishnu finally decides that he's going to fall fully asleep. And when he falls asleep, the whole world is just absorbed back into him. And there it remains in a non-existent state for millions of years, until Vishnu decides to wake up again, and in his imagination another vast universe is produced. And by some lucky chance, we may be in that other universe. In Islam, you never have a picture of God. You don't even have a picture of Muhammad. In the Islamic religion, one is not supposed to idealize or make an apotheosis of the human figure. And so God, Allah, the infinite, the eternal, can only be known through his names. There are 99 beautiful names of God, and these are said to be the qualities of God. And so the Muslim tries to connect himself with the formless, shapeless divine through these sacred names, such as the beneficent, the beautiful, the forgiving, the merciful, and so on. These are among the beautiful names of God. But there is nothing of the divine nature that one can grasp hold of and relate to. Nothing at all. And then, of course, in Christianity, you have the pernicious doctrine of three separate gods. Three thrones strung together, and there's always a conference going on between the person called the Father, the person called the Son, the person called the Holy Ghost. And this creates all sorts of intellectual, theological, philosophical, and personal difficulties. Now, Swedenborg cuts right through this mass of theological confusion. He's not interested in saying what God is, but he very clearly defines who God is. Now, this is important. The philosophers are trying to find out what God is. Is he an energy? Is he an intellectual thing? Is he a dream or what? But Swedenborg says, never mind that rubbish. It is who God is that counts. And he is so crystal clear about it, that for him, Jesus Christ is the living God. Now, for many people who don't have these feelings, it's very hard to grasp. But when you do grasp it, I can assure you, an extraordinary change comes over one. I was just a young person. I've been reading a lot of Swedenborg, and I was playing golf with a friend on a golf course, and he was a scholarly sort of man, always writing articles for religious journals and so on. And this realization suddenly hit me about the nature of Jesus Christ. It just hit me like a bolt out of the blue. Well, I couldn't contain myself, and I got hold of him and I shook his arm and I poured all this out, and he looked at me and he said, "I would give £10,000 if you could prove this to me." That's the only reply he had. But I can remember being so shaken, so profoundly shaken by that realization. It is something that arrives in one. And you can't just make it happen by pure logical reasoning, although reasoning can lead to the point of insight. Now, the whole point is this. Who and what are we going to relate ourselves to? The ancients, they understood that there was an infinite power and energy which they called Jehovah or Yahweh. And they couldn't bring themselves to pronounce that sacred name. And so they used the term the Lord. The Lord was their way of describing God to themselves. And amongst many of these very early celestial people of the most ancient church, from time to time they would see an angelic form or vision of this being whom they called the Lord. It was always a human figure that would appear to them, and they could talk to it and address it and so on. Then gradually people fell into theological philosophy, and all these ideas became very, very hazy. But then with the incarnation of Christ, you have this bringing together of heaven and earth. And Swedenborg goes to tedious lengths to point out, with numerous New Testament quotations and so on, and Old Testament quotations, that God and Christ are one and the same. Using Christ's own words, "He that seeth me seeth the Father. I am life, I am the way," and so on. Now, once our minds can begin to grasp that God is divine man being in the fullest sense of the word, then we've got something real and tangible to cling to. You see, for the ancients and for many modern philosophers, God is all this vastness of energy. All right, well, that's what we can refer to as Yahweh or Jehovah. That is the infinite, the vastness. But as we said before, how can you grasp any part of it? How can you relate to it if it's infinite? We are finite. The finite can never control the infinite in any way at all. Now, say that the whole space of that board is the infinite presence of the divine creativity. As such, it is helpless to do anything. It cannot do anything as long as it's just an infinite ocean of energy. It's got all power and all capacity. But until it generates itself to become, as it were, a finite center, now it's only an appearance, it is that focusing of energy upon itself that creates the Lord. The Lord is the personification and central focus of the infinite whole. That now is an active creative center that generates worlds, it generates stars and planets, it generates human beings and all sorts of living things. It is the active center of the universe. Now, that Lord eventually, with regard to the earth, becomes connected with a human being who is born as Jesus, and the whole soul of Jesus is the Lord God. The body, and because it's born of an earthly mother, has the human genetic weaknesses and links. So in that state, God goes through the process of overcoming human limitations to an extraordinary degree. The divine puts down all these feeble states, these weaknesses, which is briefly summarized as temptations and so on. And in doing so, shows it's possible to overcome these organic limitations and to form these connections with the one reality. And hence the prayer that his disciples and followers will be in him as he is one with the divine Father. The life of Christ shows the pattern that we follow in being able to overcome and put aside our organic weaknesses, which we must consciously perceive. That's why we must have this wakefulness. And shows the pathway that leads to conjunction with the Lord God. Swedenborg quotes the following from The Celestial World. And he said the celestial angelic view is summarized as follows, where they say, God is Jesus Christ, who is Jehovah the Lord, the creator from eternity, the redeemer in time, and the regenerator for eternity to come. That's in the True Christian Religion, number 26, verse 2. This helps us to understand so much that's in the scriptures. It helps us to understand so much that stands behind the formality of the Christian religion. That's our goal. Our goal is to attain a state of conjunction with God. When we start to form that conjunction, we become a church. We become a church through having consciousness, through cleansing out the rubbish from the inside. The whole drama of Christ's life is the pattern of what we must follow within ourselves. And Swedenborg is very firm on this. Starting with volume 2 or volume 3 of the Arcana Celestia is the inner story of Christ's infancy, his childhood, his education, the various struggles he went against, going against the weaknesses, the genetic human weaknesses. The Arcana Celestia is a volume that has so much in it that it would take a lifetime to appreciate all that's gone into its making. Swedenborg wrote the Arcana Celestia in about 8 years, but that was because there was an incessant influx through him. That's when he was the servant of Jesus Christ. Something was pouring through him. As you said, he even had angelic help with his hands, not automatic writing, but he could be sustained. the dictation was given to him at such a pace that with angelic help he could continue writing prolifically. So he has communicated to human beings a way of inner growth and transformation. Many schools, many esoteric schools in the East have sought for these ways and methods of growth and transformation. People, we've got the methodology at hand. Our job is to understand the methodology. Our job is to apply it. Our job is to act as a link between heaven and earth. Our job is to be responsible for ourselves and to grow a conscious, loving soul that is of use to the divine and is of use to the whole universe. All that is just part of Swedenborg's mighty contribution to helping we human beings to become what we should be. Thank you very much.